From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. If you're stuck in traffic tonight, you are not alone, and it's not just your neighbor in the next lane with you either. A new study shows that all around the country, congestion on roads is getting worse. Mounting traffic affects people's work habits and tears into family time. It also exacts a toll on the planet. But after all these years, what's the solution? Tonight on Point, America stuck in traffic. We begin tonight in Washington, where Congress is considering a transportation spending bill earmarked for nearly $300 billion. President Bush has threatened to veto any bill over $284 billion. Tension is high over the billions in that gap. Isaiah Poole is transportation reporter for Congressional Quarterly. Isaiah, thanks for being with us tonight.
And thank you. It's my pleasure.
So describe the standoff here. The Senate defying the White House on highway bill is the headline. What's going on?
Well, what's going on is that Senator Charles Grassley, the chair of the Senate Finance Committee, has proposed several measures that would increase the amount of money that's collected for highways and public transit systems. He wants to add about $11 billion over a 10-year period. Over the period of time that's in the bill that's currently on the Senate floor.
With new taxes, Isaiah, or how would he get those?
Senator Grassley would not call them new taxes. We're talking about recouping funds that he believes are lost fuel fraud evasion schemes.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the money would come from a gas guzzler tax that the government currently collects but does not use for highways. That money now goes into the general fund.
We've got billions in deficits. Here we've got a standoff over the difference between $284 billion and $300 billion. I mean, I know, you know, a billion here, a billion there, pretty soon it's real money, but why is the White House going to the mat on this one?
Well, the White House insists that $284 billion is really the maximum amount that is available to the federal government to pay for highway projects without increasing taxes or without increasing the deficit. And, of course, that's a point of contention between the administration and many senators who believe that the government can do better than that even without raising taxes.
What's in this bill? We've seen what looks like pork barrel here, a new Packard Museum in Ohio, money for snowmobiles in snowy states, for horse trails in horsey states. How much of this is really about getting the country's traffic moving?
Well, a lot of that was in a bill that the House of Representatives passed in March. Defenders of the bill say that those things are just a small percentage of the bill. The bulk of it would, in fact, be distributed to state departments of transportation to build new roads, to repair bridges, to start new light rail and bus rapid transit systems. And about $6 billion would go for safety programs that range from encouraging people to use seat belts to doing studies on how to repair rural roads or even urban roads that have high incidence of accidents.
And Isaiah, what about fuel efficiency? Does it have any place in this legislation? What's asked of car manufacturers?
Not directly. And that was something that was brought up by Senator Maria Cantwell, who is considering an amendment that may be added to the bill that would change what she calls an outdated methodology for the way the Environmental Protection Agency calculates fuel efficiency of cars. She wants a method that would come closer to the real-world driving experience that people have every day.
In other words, how they actually use fuel on the road instead of some hypothetical. Meanwhile, we've got a Republican House and a Republican Senate. Does that mean, and a Republican White House, that surely means that at some point they'll come to an agreement here?
Well, they didn't come to an agreement last year and where you had the same scenario. And that was because they could not come to an agreement on how to, not only on the final funding figure, but on how to distribute the money among the states.
And when they don't come to an agreement, what happens? Was it dispersed anyway, the funds, somehow?
There is what happens is that you revert to the funding in current law, which has been in place since 1998. So there's an appropriation that goes out based on old law that allows states to maintain the roads that currently exist, but does not allow for new projects.
So American Highway is on autopilot in that case. That sounds familiar. Isaiah Poole, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
Isaiah Poole, transportation reporter for Congressional Quarterly. He spoke with me from Washington. The amount of time Americans spend in their cars has tripled in the past 20 years. The total gallons of wasted, burned in traffic, fuel, has gone up fourfold. And it's not just cars that are out there idling. There's a lot of people time left on the highway, too. A new study of traffic congestion is just out, and it points, after years of public complaint and ineffective response, to more and more traffic and traffic delays. For many Americans, though, the potential solutions are unappealing, too. Carpooling and rearranging the ways cities are laid out have been political duds so far. And that brings the issue of traffic to an ideological standstill as the hours tick by and the price of gas goes up. Tonight, we're looking at America stuck in traffic. You can join the conversation. Do you drive to work? How is your commute? And what's the price to you and your community of all those creeping cars on the road? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from College Station, Texas, is Tim Lomax. He's research engineer at Texas A&M's Texas Transportation Institute and co-author of the 2005 Urban Mobility Report. It's a report published yearly and compares current congestion data with research going back over 20 years. Tim Lomax, thanks a lot for being with us tonight.
Certainly. Glad to be here.
Give us the highlights of your new report, Tim. We know it's worse than ever. Give us a sense of scale. What's happening?
In 2003, the most recent year of our study, there were 3.7 billion hours of delay, 2.3 billion gallons of wasted fuel for a total congestion invoice, if you will, of $63 billion. If you just took that wasted fuel and valued it at current fuel prices, that total would be closer to $65 billion. When you break this down to sort of individual listener, peak traveler, numbers, you're talking about 47 hours of extra travel time out on the roads each year. So, in essence, six extra work days due to the traffic congestion.
47 hours a year. That's less than an hour a week for Americans in major cities. I don't know. They might shrug and say, well, an hour a week, that's no surprise. Is that worse than it used to be?
Yeah, the total for the areas in our, the 85 areas in our study used to be 16 back in 1982, and even as crept up. If we look at just the most recent year-to-year comparison, in 2002, it was also 47. So, sort of good news on the trend front. But I think some of that flattening out of the trend was due to the relatively slow economy as well.
Tim, you pay a lot of attention to traffic. What's considered the crossover line between acceptable delays and unbearable traffic? I mean, nobody expects to just zip home, never touching the brakes.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting element that probably isn't captured in our data. I think that breaking point or tipping point is probably different for different sized areas. I think folks in Los Angeles would love to have the traffic problems of someplace like Charlotte, and yet if you go to Charlotte, folks there think they've got some fairly significant traffic congestion problems. I do think this expectation issue is something that's important. I think if folks think that they can live in the suburbs and work downtown and get between those two places at 60 miles an hour on the freeway at 7:30 in the morning, you know, we as transportation people haven't done a very good job of explaining the realities.
So 47 hours a week on average for Americans in these 85 urban areas a year, and that gets down to fairly modest sized cities like Corpus Christi, Laredo, Texas, Columbia, South Carolina. But give us the top. It's a very different picture there. Los Angeles, 93 hours a year, nearly double the national average. What are the other real traffic snarl centers, urban centers in the U.S.?
San Francisco, Oakland, Washington, D.C., Atlanta, all around 70 hours or so per year. Houston and Dallas, Fort Worth area down here in Texas, around 60 hours. Same for Chicago and Detroit. They're all around 60 hours, so in essence a 1.5 work week's worth of extra travel time.
And then you get into Miami, Boston, New York, mm-hmm. Phoenix, Philadelphia, clustered around number 10 there. What about public works projects? What about more roads? Do they work? Boston's put in a huge new tunnel system right through its downtown. Other cities have spent billions on highways. Can cities build their way out of traffic?
I don't think that just building your way out of traffic is going to be successful. Certainly over the 20 years of data that we have, it's pretty clear that just pursuing a road strategy or just pursuing a public transportation strategy is not really going to be successful. It really takes a range of different improvements, particularly into the operations and demand management strategies, the ones you suggested that maybe people aren't all that excited about. But, you know, there's a lot more ability to do telecommuting or flexible work hours or things like that now than there used to be.
You'd think that would cut the hours, but here it hasn't really. Are you amazed after all these years you've been looking at this, Tim, since your graduate work in college, that this hasn't dropped, that Americans are putting up with this?
Well, again, I think this is part of that expectation issue. Certainly folks in larger metro areas are gaining something for their time in traffic. Here in College Station, a city of 150,000, we don't have a Major League Baseball team. We don't have a huge symphony or opera. You know, we're giving up something in relation to what folks in the bigger cities get. We maybe don't have as many different job opportunities.
So people are willing to sit in that car to make all that happen. Tim Lomax, stand by. We're talking tonight about traffic. It's bad in many places, getting worse. You can join the conversation tonight. Do you drive to work? How's your commute? How could it be better? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about traffic. It's bad in many places, worse than ever. We're looking at why it's worst, what it costs us, and whether it's ever going to get better. You can join the conversation tonight. Are you caught in the cycle of high traffic congestion? And why does the American Traffic Report just sit there, static or getting worse? What would it take to make it better? Have you ever calculated the chunk of time and opportunity that traffic takes out of your life? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joined tonight from College Station, Texas, by Tim Lomax, research engineer at Texas A&M on the Texas Transportation Institute, author of the 2005 Urban Mobility Report. We're joined as well right now from Atlanta by Catherine Ross. She's director of the Center for Quality Growth and Regional Development at Georgia Tech's College of Architecture. She was the first executive director of the Georgia Regional Transportation Authority, which helped counties develop new transportation plans to meet the clean air requirements. Catherine Ross, thank you very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
I guess Atlanta knows something about traffic from what I've seen over the years. You're no stranger to it down there. What's driving high traffic congestion in the United States? Is it just more people, more cars on the road? Is it changing residential patterns? What's behind it, Catherine?
I think it's a combination. It's more people, and they're traveling more. You know, we used to talk about the four-day work week and traffic would go down. Well, of course, on that fifth day now, you don't stay home, you travel.
And then there's the sixth day and the seventh
exactly.
day.
And so I think we're seeing a greater demand for mobility in addition to, obviously, tremendous population increases. Certainly, that's a big issue for us here in Atlanta.
What about residential patterns? We hear a lot about exurbia. Does that disperse? You think it might disperse traffic out into other commercial centers, or does it just make longer commuting trails for people to follow every day and bunch up together on?
Oh, it disperses traffic into other community and activity centers. And in fact, I think some of our worst traffic congestions, which Tim's report doesn't speak to, is what's looking at the suburban areas. What is the level of congestion they're experiencing? So I think that the long commutes, the kind of sprawl pattern that we've had, has very much impacted the kind of delay congestion levels we're seeing now.
Now, he does look out to communities like Colorado Springs,
right.
Charleston, South Carolina, Pensacola, Florida, Cape Coral, Florida. I mean, these are not exactly mega cities, but they've got pretty darn high levels of annual delay on the highways. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about?
Absolutely. I think and the report makes a very important point in regard to we're seeing growing congestion levels across varying city sizes. So it's not just a mega city, super city, large urban area phenomenon. In fact, we're seeing it in small and medium-sized urban areas as well.
Tim Lomax, do you look off the beaten path, off the big highways, at side street congestion as well? Does your study take that into account? We've seen reports that even the kind of, you know, back streets are getting clogged up now in places.
Yeah, we look at the freeways and the major streets. I think maybe what you're speaking of is the diversion traffic, or the folks who try to avoid congestion by going through neighborhoods, cutting through neighborhoods. We don't really look at that level of street, but certainly around some of the freeways in the U.S., that's a big problem.
That people are getting off the major highways, going onto other main roads, and filling them up as well.
And minor roads, and roads past folks' houses.
Catherine, it's so many years that the country's been complaining about traffic and working on traffic and building more highways and talking about carpooling and telecommuting and all the rest. Why doesn't this change? Why doesn't it get better?
Well, I think there are a number of reasons. One, I think that the whole question of people's acceptance and getting more comfortable because they don't have any choice in many instances was the delay that we're now seeing, particularly here in Atlanta. So I think the expectations and the set of expectations has changed and is constantly changing. And I think that happens in response to the kinds of delay and congestion we're confronted with on a daily basis. You make different decisions about when you are going to make a trip. Some trips that might have been made won't happen now because of congestion, and you know it's going to take you two or three times as long. So I think there's a real cause and effect relationship in terms of our expectations, decisions we make about travel, and the time at which we're going to make those trips.
That people just build it into their lives and come to accept it by habit, by familiarity?
I think they are building it into their lives and accommodating it and leaving appropriate travel times to get to that all-important meeting or reunion or social outing.
And what's your sense of the cost to a community, Catherine? We heard Tim Lomax put out these mega numbers of billions and billions and billions to the economy overall. What about the environment? What about the family? What about the community life when people aren't, you know, getting together? They're sitting in cars.
Well, I think there's a tremendous cost. There's no doubt about that. I think we're also seeing some increased sensitivity to what this congestion really means. We can certainly put a price on it, and we can talk about how much time it consumes. But you really have some important questions in regard to our environment. How sustainable is this model that we have in front of us? Can we do this forever? Or are we likely to hit some issues that really cause us to rethink, if you will, this whole notion that we have in regard to the solutions we're looking at to respond to obviously trying to reduce our congestion. But the whole question of the environment, the whole air quality issue, the quality of life issue, I think are really important ones that resonates among Americans. They always have, and I can't help but think that will continue to be the case in the future, and that more and more we're going to ask the question of infrastructure, which certainly gets us from point A to point B, but more importantly, what is the role of it? What is the impact of that on quality of life?
Not to mention the price of gas just going right through the roof lately.
Which is a big consideration right now.
That's what's burning out there, by and large. I want to get to our callers. A lot of want to join us tonight. Maybe they're stuck on the highway for all I know. Karen's calling from Reading, Massachusetts. Hi, Karen. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for having me on the air.
Yeah.
I want to say that traffic changed my life. My husband is a biomedical engineer.
Traffic changed your life? How?
It did.
How?
He had to commute over an hour to a job, you know, almost in southern New Hampshire. And our quality of life went down. He wasn't home a lot of the time.
This was an hour each way, Karen, every morning, every night?
An hour each way, every morning in traffic.
Yep.
And we made a decision, because of his quality of life, that he would leave his job. And we bought a smaller house, and we started a small business out of the home.
Well, traffic changed your life. And how can you feel it in your life? Can you feel the difference between commuting and not commuting?
I can't. It's an extreme difference. It's a difference between a husband who's here, who's attentive, who has the ability to spend time with our children, to read to them. It's someone that you can go to lunch with. I mean, my husband's become like my companion again, as opposed to someone who I would only see for 2 hours at night and then was gone in the morning.
Amazing. There's the testimonial. Traffic changed my life. And in your case, it's ended up for the better, but it's by just opting out. Karen, thanks for your call. Tim Lomax, how about that quality of life issue and behaviors, the way people are responding? Do you see Americans moving either their work or their residence to avoid sitting on the highway?
Well, I think it's probably a number of things. Obviously, schools, price of homes, where you and or your spouse have a job, or if you have a medical situation, or you're going to back to school. There's a whole lot of things that go into location choice. But I think if you look at some of the home seller surveys, they indicate that there are some folks who move to avoid congestion. But just globally, it's pretty obvious, I think, that since the 60s, the people have been moving to the suburbs, and the jobs have been following them to the suburbs. And to the extent that we don't have land use controls in place that keep that from happening, I think that's a broader trend that we've seen.
But you'd think if the jobs followed them to the suburbs, that would keep the homes and the workplaces closer together and reduce traffic times. Yet you and Catherine Ross are saying even in the suburbs, you're getting traffic.
Yeah, just as Dr. Ross pointed out, you've got all of these folks out in the suburbs who are also commuting back and forth. And if you're in the suburbs, typically public transportation, walking, biking, all the other possible modes more typical of the downtown commute are not really there, are not really viable options for a lot of folks.
Not to mention you may be on two-lane highways, not eight-lane.
Right. And you have lots of folks with two-earner households that are going two different directions, and so you don't really have the opportunity to combine trips either.
Tina's calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Tina. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
Living in Raleigh, I purely blame poor planning. I'm very lucky in that I have a job that during rush hour would take me twice the amount of time that it takes me now, because I'm able to travel during off-peak hours.
Lucky you. What's the poor planning you see, Tina?
Very lucky. Poor planning in that Raleigh, just as the lady from Atlanta was speaking, Raleigh has just grown tremendously, this entire area. And the city planners and regional, it really needs to be a regional planning system.
Mm-hmm.
We have, we're called a research triangle. We have Raleigh, Durham, and Chapel Hill. And
yep.
People often live in Raleigh and commute to Chapel Hill. And there's just not great road planning to go along with that. So I think it's going to take a lot of planning to get us where we need to be, not to mention we need some public transportation, better public transportation in this area. I mean, I've lived in Washington, D.C., and this is nothing compared to that, believe me.
Yeah, that's one of the top congestion cities in the country there, number three.
Exactly, but some additional planning, definitely. I live in a community outside of Raleigh I hope is taking some care into planning, because it's, again, one of those suburbs that can run into that problem.
Yeah, so you've had great growth in Raleigh and the Research Triangle, as you described, Tina, but then there's a cost that comes with that. You've managed to end run it. Thanks for your story. Catherine Ross, how about it? I mean, there's a kind of conundrum here, which is that communities want business, and they want, by and large, they want more people, they want to grow. Yet when they do, they run smack into traffic. So has anybody found the magic way out of that?
I don't think so. I think the previous caller referenced poor planning. I think she absolutely has that correct. But a lot of that is a function of the preference that many have shown in regard to living patterns. But the challenge, it seems to me, is to figure out how, in fact, you accommodate some of that growth and invest, as I think is suggested in the 2005 Urban Mobility Report, in a variety of solutions that allows you to balance that so you don't totally sacrifice quality of life.
You mean more highways, public transportation?
Public transit, more traffic operations. I would suggest even the consideration of more rail, different technologies, all of which I think give us a better opportunity to confront and combat this congestion that we're all experiencing.
And lots of communities at least dabble in those things, and yet the traffic grows. Tim Lomax, Catherine Ross, please stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation from San Diego, California, Eric Schreffler. He's an independent transportation consultant who specializes in evaluating whether people change their behavior when offered alternative commuting options. Eric Schreffler, thanks for being with us tonight.
My pleasure, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So you've seen Tim's figures, I'm sure. They're high and growing in many communities. What's the behavioral angle that we should pay attention to here? Are human beings rational when it comes to commuting, to driving, to traffic patterns?
Well, actually, I think commuters are very rational economic beings. They know that driving is convenient, and they view, even with high gas prices, they view the out-of-pocket cost to be relatively low, and for that reason, you probably need to hit them in the pocketbooks, because they are rational economic beings.
So when you give them alternatives, you're saying people sometimes take them and sometimes don't. How do folks decide?
Well, I think that if you just simply offer the alternatives, if you simply say there is a carpool or a bus available, or you might be able to talk your employer into allowing you to work at home, I think often commuters, that's a little bit too big of a hurdle to overcome. But we found that really offering some kind of a small financial incentive seems to be the key. You really kind of need to pay them to try it.
Pay them to do what? To do what kind of thing, Eric?
Well, in Atlanta, where Catherine is, Atlanta, they have a kind of a landmark program called Cash for Commuters, where somebody that's currently driving alone could get paid by the local clean air program $2 a day if they're willing to try an alternative mode. And they get paid that for 3 months. At the end of the 3 months, it goes away, but a large proportion of them continue to carpool even after the financial incentive goes away.
That's interesting. Just a little money to get them over that hump. On the other hand, Catherine Ross, we've heard about some cities opening up what were formerly carpool lanes, high occupancy HOV lanes, to people who are willing to pay. Like pay for single drivers to get into the multi-passenger lane and zip along.
Well, of course, you know we're market-driven, and if there are people who are willing to pay, we are certainly not adverse to taking advantage of that. But I think you pose an interesting question. It goes back to this issue of sort of operations and more alternatives. One of the things that's getting a lot of attention now is separating truck and auto traffic. They were beginning to expect some significant time savings in that regard. So I think this question of whether it's incentive financially in carpooling or in terms of looking at traffic operations measures, it's a combination of those that I think gives us the best chance.
Do you mean just putting trucks in different lanes or actually moving them onto different highways?
Both. That maybe there's highways truck only lanes, right, where only trucks operate. And then we're looking at least some discussion that has to do with moving cars and trucks so they aren't – one of the big issues in terms of some of these big trucks, as you know, is visual intimidation, et cetera. And so initial studies have indicated substantial time savings if we do that.
Well, I certainly love driving without them, but then I want my mail on time, too, and that truck has to go somewhere. Stephen's calling from Westwood, Massachusetts. Stephen, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Great. Thanks, Stephen. What's on your mind?
I think there is an unexpected side effect of traffic tie-ups throughout this country. It's a bit of a pet theory that I've been harboring for years now, but
okay,
your screener
let's
very well understood my point.
Yeah.
In my opinion, there's been a cultural shift politically in this country as the result of being tied up in traffic in an increased fashion year by year, because more and more people, after listening to the traffic report and what's the latest, are angry and frustrated, and they align themselves with AM talk radio, which is very Republican, and they sit in their cars and they listen to AM talk radio because they're angry and they're seeking kindred spirits who are frustrated and angry.
So traffic elected George Bush.
You got it. If John Kerry did not lobby for the big dig, or if he didn't lobby for the big dig, he may have done himself in, depending on whether the big dig increased traffic or didn't.
Well, that is interesting. Stephen, let us pick it up. We got your pet theory right front and center here. Eric Schreffler, what about this? You're the behavioralist here. Can you see, I don't know, blood pressure rising, political frustration rising, angry political attitudes rising? Can you imagine that because of traffic?
Well, I do. It's so refreshing coming from somewhere like San Diego or Tim in Texas to have that kind of fresh view of the impact of AM radio. So I applaud Stephen for his theory. I do think frustration levels are clearly going up, but how does it change behavior? I think, again, if you don't pay folks, there is some programs around the country that on very bad air quality days, on smoggy days, tell people it's better for you to try to use an alternative mode or do some things to help clean the air. So they put a plea out to get them to change their travel behavior. And we did some studies in Northern California that showed that people actually didn't change their mode. They didn't jump on a bus or into a carpool. They just put off making the trip. Well, that's good for air quality. You can do that for three or four smoggy days in the summer, but you can't do that all the time. So I think for the rest of the year, people kind of do sees, and I do think that people are actually starting to change behavior due simply to frustration. In Washington, D.C., a large survey found that one of the top reasons why people did seek an alternative was because of frustration levels. They were just tired of sitting in traffic, and they'd rather sit in the back of a van pool or on a transit than sitting in traffic. So frustration clearly is beginning to affect travel behavior.
Well, steamed and maybe angry and maybe tuning in to anger, we're glad to have all of our listeners tuning in right here tonight, even those stuck in traffic, maybe especially really stuck in traffic. Eric Schreffler, Catherine Ross, Tim Lomax, stand by. We've got to take a short break here. We're talking tonight about traffic and why it's worse, what it costs us, and whether it's ever going to get better. You can join us. Have you surrendered to traffic? Do you just take what comes? Have you figured out an escape plan? And is this most about where Americans live or how we drive or where the jobs are? What's your bright idea to fix traffic? What's your solution? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about traffic. We hope you're not stuck in it, but a lot of Americans are, more and more in more communities. We're looking at why it's worse, what it costs us tonight, and whether it's ever going to get better. You can join us tonight. Have you found a private solution to traffic? Have you moved? Have you changed jobs? Will more highway lanes fix it? More buses? More trains? What is the way out of traffic? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Lots of consequences to lots of cars on the road. We're joined tonight from College Station, Texas, by Tim Lomax, from Atlanta, by Catherine Ross, and from San Diego, by Eric Schreffler. Right now, Mark is calling from McHenry, Illinois. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hello, Tom. Great show, as always.
Thank you. Thanks.
You know, this is your Cassandra call for the evening, because I have this problem. If what I've been reading about the possibility of global peak oil production within the next 5 to 10 years or sooner,
yeah,
as outlined in the Hirsch report, which was prepared for the federal government and released last February and never heard from again.
We can certainly feel that oil tightening up. No question about that. Well, see the price at the pump.
It's not, well, actually, if the consequences of what could happen actually do happen, the cost of gasoline will be basically a minor irritant given what's coming. My feeling is that I would, as much as I love my two Mustangs, I would love to see an entire year's highway budget, a moratorium on new road construction, maybe a maintenance of existing roads, but a total moratorium on new road construction.
Yeah, and do what with all those other billions? Do what?
The dedication of that money to alternative fuel production, alternative energy sources, alternative transportation, and starting to plan for what could be, if we don't plan for it, could be the not only a self-correcting problem to the traffic congestion problem, but the greatest economic and cultural shock this country has ever seen.
Now, there would be a revolution for the automobile culture. Mark, thanks. Let us look at that. Tim Lomax, how about it? I mean, there's a kind of, I suppose, a utopian idea, but if we took that $284 billion that the president's willing to put in the highway budget and put it all into alternative fuels, alternative vehicles, would it make a difference? Are there enough resources to keep our highways working and look at alternatives to gas combustion?
I guess my initial thought is there ought to be a fair amount of private investment in looking at alternative fuels. Certainly there's a role for government, but I think on the government side, you've seen programs sort of broadly like what Mark was talking about, investments in a whole range of elements designed to produce transportation results. Houston, for the last decade or so, has invested in inner-city neighborhoods, attempting to compete better against the suburbs for folks who are interested in an urban lifestyle, but maybe driven away by some of the poor infrastructure or poor poor security feeling.
Has that worked for Houston?
It's actually reversed the flight from the downtown or the near town area, and they figured they were losing about 5,000 people a year back in the early 90s. They're now gaining 5,000 people a year.
But they're still right here near the top of your traffic congestion list.
Well, again, that's not a huge shift if you're talking about 2 million people in the Houston area over the next 20 years. Again, think of these as niche markets, some different sets of housing. Not everybody wants to live in the suburbs,
right,
or the rural areas. Not everybody wants to travel by themselves. Not everybody wants to carpool or vanpool.
So woo them back to the city center where they don't have such a big commute. Eric Schreffler, what about oil constraints, oil prices? Can you imagine spikes of such vertigo-inducing heights that they would get Americans to drive less, to jump on the bus, to carpool, to work closer to home? Will oil fix traffic, oil prices?
Well, clearly in the U.S., we have not seen the kind of increases to cause major changes in behavior. Back in the 70s, there were some federal programs to get ideas about carpooling and vanpooling off the drawing boards and to make them a reality. But, you know, a lot of the peer economists will tell you that gas prices will have to go up dramatically, four or five-fold, before you really see a behavior change. And clearly, you look at what's happening in Europe, where their prices have already been higher, and the rate of growth in travel, the rate of amount of travel that people are, more travel that people are making, is equal to that in the U.S. So higher gas prices in and of themselves have not changed behavior in Europe.
Yeah, I have to say, every time I hit the roads there, they look as bad or worse than what I see here, but you're paying a lot more for that oil. Well, Catherine Ross, is there, you talk about multiple avenues here. Our caller says, let's just pull the money out of the highway bill and put it into alternatives. How would that work? I mean, I know one thing you've been worried about is the increased population that's coming, a population bubble still on the way.
It's interesting because this question of population is something I'm afraid we're stuck with, and I think it certainly will have consequences that we have no choice but to respond to. The question of looking at alternatives, I thought it was an interesting perspective, and one of the things that I've been sort of increasingly focused on is this look at sort of economic development, redevelopment, and where you deploy your resources to improve highways or add public transit, and what's the relationship between that and economic development. I thought his question really pointed us to think about our infrastructure and our investment, the $284 billion that we're looking at, whether we take 1 year, as he's suggesting, or really look at a bit more flexibility in our investment in terms of alternative fuel, different technologies. I think that's a question well worth a bit more consideration.
Not just asphalt. Let's get another call. Mark is calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks. Years ago, I was the co-author of a federal research study, The Cost of Congestion to Urban Businesses. And the thesis was that the congestion wasn't just a burden for residents, for individuals, but that also it was a killer for business. What we found was actually some interesting effects that you did have some things like traffic contributed greatly to a drop in the afternoon newspapers in a lot of American cities.
Right.
But that by and large, the businesses adjusted. They had their deliveries more at night or off peak. And that in most cases, the businesses benefited from urban density. It was much easier for them to serve businesses in a dense city than it was, you know, to get to distant addresses in remote Death Valley or someplace like that that obviously had no traffic congestion.
So you didn't find a break point at which the traffic became so intense, so congested, that businesses said, we've got to get out of here.
Well, we looked at a variety of different types of businesses, but doing research in Los Angeles with a whole range of different companies, as well as in Boston, you know, so we did take a look at cities where there was a broad urban sprawl and those that had, you know, congested particular hotspots. But no, in general, the businesses could not identify, nor could we, a particular dollar value that the businesses incurred because of the congestion.
Fascinating. People just adjusting and living. Sorry, Mark, yes?
Well, the one interesting thing was that even though they didn't have a, what we found was even though there wasn't a particular dollar cost to the congestion, that there was this quality of life issue that affected their employees. It was up to the employee to get him or herself to work on time. But it also, as some earlier callers had discussed, and as your people on your show talked about, you know, it does affect the quality of life. And after a while, you know, Las Vegas perhaps looks more attractive than Los Angeles, or a spot where I can get to work more easily.
If you can get there, if you can drive there. Mark, thanks for your call. Eric Schreffler, how about it? Businesses and traffic. Do you say them changing their location, changing their hours policies, getting out of town to avoid it?
Well, surprisingly, the employers don't really see the connect between their operating policies and the way they treat and work with their employees and the employees' commutes. And so once they start to see that and realize the impact that commuting has on their employees, on stress levels, on absenteeism, on tardiness, they start to change their tune a little bit. But they have to see what's in it for them to get an employer to start wanting to offer alternative commute options to their employees. They really have to see what's in it for them. They've got to have a parking crunch, or more and more you're seeing frustrated employees going up the ladder to human resource saying, I want to work from home 2 days a week.
Get me out of here.
I want my transit benefit. And those grassroots programs seem to be among the most effective.
Tim Lomax, we just got a couple of minutes here. What do you see down the road? Just more congestion, more road warriors, road rage, more gallons of gas sent up into the atmosphere, burned up there, or something else?
Well, I think clearly we're in a less location-based economy, more an amenity-based economy. That's something that caller Mark and Eric spoke to, that folks have a choice. And so I think it's down to another municipal or urban region competition. I also think there's a lot of things we can do on the transportation side to make the system more reliable so you can predict your travel time, which might ease the frustration. We might not be able to get rid of the long commutes, but at least we can make them reliably long. I think that's would be a big step forward, would ease a lot of the frustration.
By better traffic control and traffic reporting.
Right.
Kevin Ross, what's your look ahead? Do you see, you're looking at that growing population estimates, at infrastructure maybe not keeping up, maybe it shouldn't, some would say, to push people elsewhere. What do you see in the future? Longer and longer and longer commutes?
Well, I certainly don't see a fundamental change in our development patterns, although I think we're beginning to see more focus at the local level and even at the regional level in some instances, asking the question, can we influence where development goes and then hopefully influence the efficiency and how much we get out of our existing and any new infrastructure? But I think this question of looking at regional competitiveness and how, in fact, we provide alternatives to get around within regions as well as to and from MSAs that are increasingly close to each other will cause another look at this whole question, and I suspect we might see some different investment decisions.
Well, whether our listeners are stuck on the road tonight or comfortable at home, we hope it gets better, and we've got some interesting ideas on the table tonight. Kathryn Ross in Atlanta, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Kathryn Ross at Georgia Tech, and Eric Schreffler, transportation consultant out of San Diego, California. Wonderful to have you tonight. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
And Tim Lomax at Texas A&M, Texas Transportation Institute, author of the 2005 Urban Mobility Report. Tim, thanks for being with us.
You're welcome.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, a political scandal shakes Spokane, Washington. This is On Point. There is a major political scandal playing out in Washington, but this one is in Washington State, far from the nation's capital. The mayor of Spokane, James West, has been accused of abusing his office by offering gifts and a city hall internship to a 17-year-old he thought he met in a gay chat room. The apparent teenager was actually the fictional creation of the local newspaper, the Spokesman Review, which deliberately set up the sting. Mayor West also stands accused of offering city jobs to two young gay men he met in a chat room and of molesting two boys back in the 1970s. West, a Republican who's been a strong public opponent of gay rights, this week acknowledged that he's gay, but he denied the charges made against him and yesterday said he would take some time off to prepare his defense.
The current news media hysteria is distracting to the business of the city and is occupying a great deal of my time. I have not taken a vacation since assuming office, January 2004. And therefore, I'm going to take a leave of a few weeks to gather my thoughts and prepare my defense of the false accusations leveled against me.
Mayor James West of Spokane. Joining me now from public radio station KPBX in Spokane is John Vlahovic, news coordinator there. John, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you for inviting me.
So the whole country is following this story in Spokane. How's Spokane taking it?
I think it's kind of reeling, mainly because this is kind of the latest drop in the bucket. We've had a number of scandals through the years and controversies through the years. You know, the Spokane Catholic Diocese is one of three going through bankruptcy because of priest sexual abuse scandals, and we had some other local things, and it just seems like, well, like this morning, one of the newspaper columnists headed out his column with the words, "Make it stop."
Yeah. What was this a complete stunner to residents of Spokane, Washington? Was it a complete shock that James West was gay and allegedly was abusing his office in this way, or was this town scuttlebutt and everybody kind of knew it already?
I would have to say it was a stunner. Of course, afterwards, there were some people, particularly some of his political colleagues, that said there'd been rumors going around, but I don't think the average man on the street had a clue until this came out last Thursday.
And now, take us through exactly what the mayor's accused of, and whether or not it's illegal or just unseemly.
That is still to be determined, because the city hall is setting up an independent investigation into whether there's misuse of or not following city policy with regard to use of internet and that sort of thing. So far, there's been no criminal charges whatsoever against the mayor. It's mainly this coming out that he's solicited dates on the chat room, and that he appears to have offered gifts and possibly internships and employment to the people he chatted with.
So not perhaps law-breaking, but also, if it were heterosexual, even kind of talking to young girls that way, it might also get people going.
Exactly. I mean, there is a specific city hall policies dealing with how you, what you can and cannot do with the city computers on your desk, and that's what they're looking into at this point.
And what about the way the Spokesman Review got the story, the sting they set up, posing as a young man, kind of soliciting the mayor's attention? Are people, are they critical of that, admiring of that? How's it being received?
It's kind of come down on both sides of that. The newspaper is justifying it in that there was no other way that they could definitely know that the individual on the other end of that chat room internet line was the mayor. As they said, it could have been anybody until they used this sting operation to do it. So that's why they're justifying the use of that kind of an operation.
And what about Mayor West's record on gay issues as a legislator? Of course, he was in the Washington State Legislature, and as mayor. He's summarized as anti-gay. What's the record look like?
Well, that's very definitely. It goes, I've got a listing here going all the way back to 1985, when the then governor signed an executive order banning discrimination in the state based on the state hiring, that is, based on sexual orientation. And he was one of 14 other Republicans who introduced a bill to bar gay men and lesbians from working in schools, daycare centers, and this sort of thing. And there's a record that goes on pretty consistently that way.
Well, how the worm turns. We'll be watching. John, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
John Vlahovic is news coordinator at KPBX in Spokane, Washington. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jupp, Eileen Amata, Rachel Dornhelm, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Pamela Ferdinand, Tim Skog, Michael Garth, and Angel Cozzelli. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.